Good evening, David. Welcome to the Space Show.
How do you do, Andrew?
Space. Big topic. Astronomy in space. We know about the Hubble Space Telescope, but seeing visible light is not the only way to look at the sky, is it?
No, and it's not the only way to get high resolution is to put just an optical telescope above the atmosphere.
Some of the other ways being?
Well, as far as the radio astronomers are concerned, we started out facing an enormous disadvantage. That was the difference in wavelengths. Now, the resolution of any telescope is the wavelength divided by the size of the telescope. So at optical wavelengths where you've got typical wavelength of, say, half a micron, half a millionth of a metre, to get a certain resolution you need a telescope that's typically tens of centimetres or a few metres in size. And then on top of that, with an optical telescope, you have to look out through the Earth's atmosphere, which blurs the images regardless to roughly about 1 second of arc resolution.
That's the same sort of blurring as makes the stars twinkle, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. It looks pretty on a cold winter's night, but it sure as hell makes it difficult when you're collecting optical photons from, say, a distant galaxy or quasar. Because the image is spread out, you get a lot more noise from your detectors. So the optical astronomers, to get around the atmospheric blurring problem, put, I think it was $2 billion into the Hubble Space Telescope to actually lift it above the atmosphere. Now, the radio astronomers, we spent, started out with a disadvantage, and that is the ratio of the wavelengths. We're working at wavelengths of, say, 10 centimetres, which is 100,000 times longer than optical wavelengths. So to get the same angular resolution, we have to build a telescope 100,000 times longer than 10 centimetres, and that's many hundreds of kilometres in size.
And of course you can't build a single telescope that big.
No.
So the first radio telescopes that were made after the Second World War then had very low resolution. They could basically just pick up a signal but couldn't image it.
That's correct, and in fact, soon after the war, the major discovery during the war, was the Sun. The Sun was picked up as a radio source, I guess, long before it was ever published scientifically, as an interfering radio source when the British radars looked across the Channel. They were, I gather, a little concerned that the Germans would attack them out of the Sun in a traditional fashion, but fortunately they didn't. The Sun just emits radio noise and interferes with the radar sets at that time. So the first detected objects after the war were the Sun and also our galaxy itself, the centre of our galaxy, which passes overhead at about 10 p.m. on a winter's night in July, is one of the most spectacular optical sights, I think, in the world. But it is also a source of very strong radio emission. In fact, that's one of the huge advantages that Australian radio astronomers have, is that one of the most interesting objects in the sky passes right overhead, whereas in the northern hemisphere they have to scrape the horizon to look at it.
So obviously you build a single telescope larger and larger in order to collect more energy, but it doesn't really give you much more resolution, does it?
No, the resolution goes up, but you run into the situation very quickly in radio astronomy in that your sensitivity beats your resolution, in the sense that everywhere you look there starts to be what are called confusing sources. You have so many weak sources in the sky that with an ordinary telescope it's difficult to separate them out. So one of the ways around that, first of all, was to decrease the wavelengths. The first wavelengths observed were typically of the order of meters. That was frequencies, typically FM style frequencies, 100 or a couple of hundred megahertz. But even going to short wavelengths then meant that you had to start building precision radio telescopes. No longer was it wood and chicken wire, or even pipe and chicken wire. And so there were, soon after the war, in 10 years after the war, there were a lot of very innovative attempts to get high resolution, and a lot of those were also carried out here in Australia in the Southern Hemisphere. And that ended up with the, if you like, the sort of difference. One approach was the large single-dish telescope approach, that was Parkes. The other approach was that was adopted here in Australia, the two others. One was the cross-type telescope, that's the Mills Cross Telescope, and there is a big one of those near Canberra still in operation. And the third approach, which was adopted by the School of Electrical Engineering at Sydney University, and that was the interferometer. They were often arranged in the style of a cross. And in fact, all of those were used quite a lot indiscriminately. It's just that when the level of funds got quite large, That's the level of funds to build a 64-metre telescope, or a 210-foot as it was in those days, was very big. Then the competition really became fierce. But there was an enormous, diverse lot of work done in Australia with interferometers, with cross-type telescopes, and also with fairly large single dishes. And the net result out of that is that, in the longer term, interferometers, in a sense, have won for getting high angular resolution.
Okay. So an interferometer then just collects the signals with using different telescopes and then combines them electronically.
That's right. It's as though you've taken a telescope which is like kilometres in diameter and you've broken off sections of that telescope. So instead of the sections coming to one focus, they come to two separate focuses or foci. But then the trick is to make sure that the signals themselves are not distorted. You have to maintain their phase relationship at the radio frequency at, say, 1 or 2 or 3 gigahertz. So you've got to be very careful in bringing those signals back together. And I guess the best example in Australia of an interferometer that does this and does this exceedingly well as being a beautiful radio telescope, is the Australia Telescope Compact Array at Narrabri. I think anybody who's driving from Melbourne up to Brisbane, I guess as a lot of people want to do in the winter, really should take the, not go the coast road, either going up or back, but should go up through places like parks, well, first of all through Canberra to see the NASA tracking stations there, and then up through parks and Narrabri and stopping at Siding Spring to see the 4-metre optical telescope there. For anybody who's interested in astronomy and space, it really is a nice way to spend a couple of days getting to Brisbane.
Yes, even for those who haven't got a particular interest, I'm sure they'd find it very, very interesting.
That's right. In fact, it's a very powerful access. I work in Canberra, and I work with CSIRO, but the reason I'm in Canberra is that we have an agreement with the United States, with NASA, and I spent 10 years in the States building up this sort of rapport, amongst other things, with my colleagues in the States. And so we use the NASA tracking station radio telescopes when they're not tracking spacecraft. Very often they're off doing Australian radio astronomy. It's a very nice agreement in that we get access to the best telescopes in Australia, and they also get a significant return, I think, from the astronomers in terms of evaluation of the performance of the telescopes, and just many of the techniques, in fact, that we've developed end up involved in tracking spacecraft.
Okay, then, so you're getting these signals back from the sky, radio signals, and you can basically turn them into images, providing you can get the telescopes far enough apart. Now, at Narrabri, they are about, 6 kilometres apart?
6 kilometres, yes.
Yes, can we go up from there?
Yes, you can. There are two parts to it. The finest detail, if you like, you can see is a function of the maximum separation of your telescopes. The larger the separation, the finer the detail. That's the wavelength divided by the distance or the size. The other thing you really like to get is good quality images. And the quality images are a function, if you like, of the number and distribution of telescopes. So if you want just fine detail, in a sense, you can get away with two telescopes. But if you want to build up a really sensible image that images the large and the small components of the object that you're looking at, you really need a good distribution of radio telescopes. Now, the real problem with the compact array, this problem that I mentioned before of getting the signals back together in phase, is handled by having high-quality electronics and also by connecting them up very carefully with optical fibres, so that you really do maintain phase. And remember, this phase is the equivalent, if a wavelength is a few centimetres, a few degrees of phase is a few millimetres. So you really have to maintain the integrity at the millimetre level, in fact, over the 6 kilometres. Now, if you want to go to more than 6 kilometres, if you want to get the sort of resolution that the Hubble telescope is getting, for example, you've got to go to spacings of 60 or 100 kilometres. Now, it gets very, very expensive to lay optical fibres and to maintain them in such a way that you really can preserve the phase. And if you want to go not 60 kilometres but 600 or 6,000 kilometres, it basically becomes very, very, very expensive. I mean, optical fibre coaxial cable costs $10 a metre of that order. So for every kilometre, that gets to be a lot of money very, very quickly.
So do you often hook in Parkes and the radio telescope that's at Siding Spring into the Narrabri network?
Yes, we do. In fact, late in the 1960s, there was a technique developed called VLBI. At that stage in the 1960s in the US, the instrument that was being built was the Very Large Array with its acronym VLA. So if you want to build something in addition to the VLA and you want an acronym, you choose an acronym. The obvious one that we chose was VLB. B comes after A. So it's called Very Long Baseline Interferometry. The acronym is VLBI. And the technique that it uses is to totally break the dependence on linking the telescopes with cables of any sort. And for this very high quality cable, you replace it with an atomic clock. The ones that are readily available are things called rubidium standards, or there are things called hydrogen masers, which have unbelievable timekeeping and frequency stability properties. But if you can break the connection with these atomic clocks and high-speed tape recorders, in fact, the technique then says if you take your suitcase with an atomic clock and your tape recorder, you can go to any telescope on Earth, and you can link it effectively with any other telescope on Earth. So once that nexus was broken, in fact, there was a real blossoming of what's called VLBI. And in fact, on the Earth these days, routinely, radio astronomers are building images with a resolution 100 times better than the Hubble Space Telescope.
Really? So in terms of angle, what would that? How many degrees would that be, or how many minutes of arc?
Well, in terms of angle, we normally measure angles in milliarc seconds. That's 1,000th of an arc second. That's 1,000 times better than, say, your average image size at the Anglo-Australian telescope, which is typically one arc second. The Hubble Space Telescope is typically 0.1, even if it was working properly, and we're on the ground routinely getting at least a factor of 100 better than that. But remember, to do it, we haven't built a telescope that's 4 metres in diameter or 6 kilometres in diameter. It's effectively 10,000 kilometres in diameter. It's roughly one Earth diameter.
So you've got one telescope on one side of the Earth and another one on the other side, and then you record the data?
That's right. And for preference to get that image quality back again, it's not just one at one end and one at the other. We have telescopes literally spread across the Earth. So in fact, for the last 10 or 15 years in Australia, we've been building up international connections, and we now have routinely run these VLBI experiments with every continent on the Earth, from, from Alaska, Russia, Japan, China, Europe, the United States, South Africa, South America, and even Antarctica.
Well, can we go any bigger than that?
Oh, not only can we have. The way that we did that was to go into space. I mean, clearly, once you break this concept of having wires to connect your telescope really can go anywhere. And when we first developed this technique 30 years ago, it was realised. I mean, the original reaction was, okay, let's put a telescope on a yacht. I mean, I was spending some time working in Puerto Rico at that stage, and the aim for all of us was to simply put a telescope on a yacht and go cruising around the Caribbean.
Oh, some astronomers have all the luck, don't they?
Well, we never got the money. But it was realised very quickly that, in fact, you could do that. You could put a telescope into space on a spacecraft. I mean, remember, to get the sensitivity that we want, we're going to need a telescope, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 metres in diameter. And that's a pretty big thing to actually launch into space. There have been a lot of proposals. The first really serious proposals came out of Europe and the United States. The project ended up originally being investigated by the Europeans. It was a mission called QUASAT for Quasar Satellite. We weren't terribly original in choosing the name. And the aim was to put a 10-metre radio telescope into orbit. With the dramatic increase in costs and also the very heavy competition, the Europeans decided that they wouldn't go ahead with it. Roughly at the same sort of time, there were ideas growing in the Soviet Union, as it was at that time, and also in Japan. but before they became effectively fully-fledged missions as far along as they are now, there was a demonstration put together in the mid-1980s. This was, in fact, really, a very elegant sort of experiment. The aim was to attempt to use existing radio telescopes in space. Now, the bulk of those, presumably, we're only guessing, but one can guess, I think, pretty well, are owned by the military, and they don't like to let you anywhere near them. But there is a system up there called the Tracking and Data Relay Satellite System, TDRS. And it is basically used for communications between spacecraft and the Earth. And the aim of TDRS is any satellite, say, in high or even low orbit, can broadcast to one of these TDRS satellites. They're in geostationary orbit. And then they broadcast directly down to its home base, which in this case is the United States. So basically it's a way of getting global satellite communication. And with, say, three of these TDRS satellites distributed around the geostationary orbit, you can basically communicate with any satellite anywhere. So there was a realization that these TDRS antennas, they're 4-meter antennas that simply sit there, if you like, and look at the Earth, could in fact be steered slightly off, steered to look around the Earth and look at radio sources and give us a real demonstration of space VLPI. Now, it sounds easy, it was a hell of a job, and I was involved in the Australian side of it. The main participating agencies, clearly TDRS is a US system, so it came from a jet propulsion laboratory in the United States. That's in Pasadena, California. And if you've got a satellite that's looking at America, and the only way it can actually look at the sky is to look past America, then it can only do its interferometry with telescopes that are on the other side of the Earth, on the end of the Earth. And as soon as you say the end of the Earth, you think of Australia. And because Japan is at the same longitude, in fact, this experiment was put together with the US, with Australia, and with Japan. And after a lot of effort and heartbreak, I guess, in 1986, the first successful experiments were made, actually linking a telescope in space that wasn't even designed to do it. I mean, that, if you like, is the interesting part. It was designed as a normal sort of communications antenna. And so despite all its disadvantages of small size and not being designed for the job, it proved eminently successful. And we have used it since, not only at 2.3 gigahertz, that's a wavelength of 13 centimetres. That's roughly the, you know, typically the span of your fingers. We've also used it at higher frequencies, at a wavelength of 2 centimetres, or less than an inch on the old scale. And that really demonstrated that the technology is totally feasible for a dedicated, not just a borrowed, if you like, satellite, but a dedicated satellite. And in the long and the short of that is that there are two programs that have survived. One is called Radio Astron, which is coming out of what is now Russia, and the other is VSOP. It's a Japanese program, and in their inimitable fashion, they chose the acronym and then they chose words to fit it. VSOP is not a fine brandy, but it stands for VLBI Space Observatory Program. And both of these satellites, they're due for launch in the mid-1990s. And the difference between them, if you like, and the Hubble Space Telescope is for them to operate as a real interferometer requires not just the telescope in space, but all of the telescopes on the Earth. And in fact, both of these are a veritable United Nations. They will operate in concert with all of the Earth's large radio telescopes, including Australia's.
Perhaps we should point out to our listeners that, you know, most people, when we mention the word telescope, have in their mind something that you peer through, and perhaps the Hubble telescope fairly well matches that sort of image, but the telescopes we're talking about here now more represent the dishes that sit on the TAB or the hotels, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And in fact, the image, you don't in any sense get an image in real time at all. The image comes out months, sometimes years later, as a result of a lot of careful work in terms of calibration, etc. But it comes out from a computer, because all that you get from the experiment is not an image, but a great pile of magnetic tapes. and magnetic tapes do not an image make simply. So there is a whole set of data reduction, if you like, afterwards. These tapes all have to be taken to some central processing facility, if you like, and they have to be played back. They have to be synchronized. They, in fact, end up being synchronized to much better than a millionth of a second in the playback, so that the actual data streams are slipped. And this is done afterwards, and as I said, often takes quite a while, and it's a lot of fairly careful work to produce the image. But one of the interesting sidelights, if you like, of VLBI and space VLBI is part of the solution of all of this. If you like, it's a massive equation involving all these radio telescopes spread around the Earth and the radio sources deep in space. Part of the solution actually has to locate the telescopes on the Earth itself with a precision of better than the sort of wavelength that you're looking at. So in fact, a sidelight of this VLBI, at least on the ground, is to locate the radio telescopes with a precision of typically a couple of centimetres. Now, it's a couple of centimetres surveying over distances transcontinental and intercontinental. That's distances up to, say, 10,000 kilometres. And there is no other technology, no other technique presently available that can do that sort of precision. The geophysicists, geodesists use this thing called GPS. It gives you, you know, centimetres, but it has a maximum range of typically a few hundred kilometres. VLBI gives you centimetric precision over 10,000 kilometres. And so there's a whole sidelight, if you like, of this VLBI that's gone off into organisations like the National Geodetic Survey, which is doing things like earthquake monitoring, measuring continental drift. And in fact, when I said before that we had even done experiments to Antarctica, there's an enormous potential there, because Antarctica as a continent is very sensitive to global warming. If it loses a centimetre of ice off Antarctica, that will go into the oceans. Now, the amount of sea level raising, if 1 centimetre goes from Antarctica, is of the order of a millimetre, simply because the oceans are so vast. But what does happen is, if that 1 centimetre is taken off, the Antarctic continent has a lesser ice load and will actually raise itself up some good fraction of that centimetre. So one of the potentials of VLBI is, as a sidelight, if you like, is potentially there in things like global monitoring to attempt to measure, for example, with Antarctica, if the ice coverage is significantly decreasing.
So what you're really doing is, if you know exactly the positions of the telescopes on Earth, you can precisely identify where something is in the sky. And what you're doing is turning this around. Once you know that precise position in the sky, you can then use that information to locate other radio telescopes here on Earth.
That's correct. In fact, it's basically a large simultaneous equation. And the variables include the positions of the objects in the sky that you measure, plus the positions of the radio telescopes. So that's one of the major, if you like, applications of VLBI on Earth, as well as for esoteric astronomy, measuring the nuclei of quasars with bits going off at 10 times the speed of light. It actually measures motions here on Earth at the rate of a centimetre a year.
Well, who would have believed that studying quasars could have helped us study global warming?
Well, I think it's on the way. It's one of those techniques that is there and it has the potential to go ahead. The difficulty, of course, is Antarctica is in the southern hemisphere and there is not a great deal of effort. In fact, it's interesting that a lot of the push for these measurements, in fact, comes not only from countries like Australia, but also is coming from clearly the United States. The Japanese have a significant interest because they have a radio telescope, and also there's a German group. So in fact, once again, in Antarctica, it's a large United Nations style of operation going on, and it has the potential to involve a lot more. It's only, I think, in the formative stages at present.
Okay, getting back onto the spacecraft, Radio Astron and VSOP, they're going to be put up in the mid-1990s, aren't they?
That's right. On the Radio Astron spacecraft, Australia, in fact, at the invitation of the then Soviets, is providing one of the sensitive radio receivers that goes on that spacecraft. It's at a frequency of 1.7 gigahertz, a wavelength of 18 centimetres. There'll be 4 receivers these are the radio receivers on the spacecraft. One is provided by being provided by India, that's at 327 megahertz, the 1.7 gigahertz by Australia, the 5 gigahertz is coming from Europe, and there is another at 22 gigahertz which is being supplied from Finland. So their actual components that in Australia's case are being built by Australian industry, I'll give them a plug, British Aerospace Australia and MyTech in Queensland. They're being funded from the Space Office and also from the CSIRL Office of Space Science and Applications. That's a significant component that actually will go into space on this Radio Astron spacecraft. And I think it's quite an achievement for Australian science and Australia's industry that these receivers are built. In fact, the engineering model is heading off for Russia in the next couple of weeks.
Has Australia got any involvement in the VSOC program?
No, the Japanese have chosen to go it alone. They, like everybody else, sees many of these missions as a technology development as much as the science. And so they made a unilateral decision, and they're paying the money, or as someone once said to me, they have the paintbrush. And so they effectively are doing that. However, as far as the science is concerned, they're actively seeking this same international cooperation, because at least in Russia, they have radio telescopes spread across Siberia from, you know, effectively from Moscow to Vladivostok, or from Evpatoria to Ussurisk. But the Japanese don't. They really occupy globally a small area, and so they must collaborate. And Australia is in a very good position, at least as far as the science is concerned, in that we are the main nation at the same longitude as Japan, the main radio astronomy nation. And so I think a lot of these things are in the formative process, the actual management of the science missions. There are a whole lot of international agencies, in fact, involved in putting together these groups and getting them to work out the solution. But the net result, we believe, will be that worldwide all astronomers will have access to these facilities. Australian astronomers, New Zealand astronomers, European astronomers, Russian and Japanese. So it's really a pretty enlightened approach to put these together. And I think as far as the nations that are contributing, they feel that their science is strong enough that they can compete with the world in terms of the programs that are going to go with these satellite missions.
At the moment, then, we can have a radio telescope with an effective size of the diameter of the Earth, and by the mid-1990s, we'll have a effective telescope, the diameter about 4 or 5 times the size of the Earth. Obviously, the next stage out would be to go to the Moon. Any hopes of doing that in the future?
Well, there are a number of reasons why, but there are also a number of very important reasons why not, and that really has to do with the physics of radio sources. What do you effectively measure as your angular resolution gets smaller and smaller is a thing called brightness temperature. The more flux you have, the more emission that you have coming from a smaller and smaller region, effectively the higher temperature it is. Now, what happens in astrophysics, the entities that emit radio waves are electrons, and they emit synchrotron radiation. And as you get to higher and higher brightness temperatures, you're effectively getting to higher and higher temperature electrons. Well, eventually those electrons will be going fast enough that they will lose energy not by emitting radio waves, but basically by emitting X-rays. And once they do that, they effectively quench themselves. Now, that comes at a brightness temperature of a million degrees. That's pretty hot. And we're already approaching that limit. So there are possible reasons why it may not be necessary to go to the very long baselines. There may not be anything that's hot enough to see. However, there are a few. There are other phenomena like masers and pulsars, and these things don't emit the normal synchrotron radiation. They are masers, a stimulated emission, so they can have effective brightness temperatures much, much higher. So the two missions that are going up the middle of this century, the middle of this decade, my heavens, not this century, are in a sense both imaging and exploratory. The aim is, particularly with the Russian mission Radio Astron, that has the higher orbit, 80,000 kilometres, to see what there is to be seen. I think that's a very, very important exploratory step, and indeed, if there is still much to be seen, and I mean, it's easy to argue that there won't be anything to see, but our experience in the past says that there usually will be. Mother Nature is a little more sophisticated than we often take her to be.
Well, thank you for joining us this evening on the Space Show, David.
Thank you very much, Andrew.